Performances feature drumming, songs that tell the stories of resistance and hope, and dances inspired by the orishas and traditions of Candomblé. Details about this Afro-Brazilian celebration in D.C. featuring Ileaye at educarteinc.org, educarteinc.org, or 202-450-8541.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WDFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
Welcome to a very special edition of We the People. My name is Katia Stitt. I'm subbing for David Whetstone, and this is the beginning of a series that we're doing on Gaza. And what you just heard was a group calling themselves Gaza Birds Singing, founded and led by Ahmed Mouin in the tents there, in between the tents. They are doing art. They're doing therapy. And so one of the ways that they engage the children is through singing. And this group comes out of that. It was Ahmed and several young people singing this song. We are talking today about journalists under fire. As you know, last Sunday, an Israeli airstrike targeted a media tent outside the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City. The attack murdered the entire Al Jazeera news team, including Anas Al-Sharif, a Palestinian correspondent known for his frontline reporting. In the minutes before he was killed, Al-Sharif said on social media, "If this madness does not end, Gaza will be reduced to ruins, its people, voices silenced, their faces erased, and history will remember you as silent witnesses to a genocide you chose not to stop." We are joined this morning by a journalist who is no stranger to the WPFW airwaves, starting with Democracy Now! We heard him many years ago as part of their team. That would be Sharif Abdel Quddus, a journalist and Middle East North Africa editor at Dropsite News. He joined us from Los Angeles. And Sharif, as I mentioned before, you have been doing some remarkable coverage. So if you could briefly explain to our listeners exactly first of all, thank you for joining us today. If you could explain to our listeners, let me stop. First of all, I want to offer you our condolences because I know that you knew Anas, and I know as journalists are killed, it must affect you deeply. So WPFW offers its condolences to you. If you could walk us through briefly what happened, and then talk to us about Anas's mission and the mission of all the journalists in Gaza.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on. It's always an honor to be on the airwaves of WPFW. What happened was that Anas al-Sharif was assassinated. This is not in dispute. The Israeli military has proudly proclaimed this and bragged about it. And he was assassinated despite him multiple times posting and saying online and on the air that he's being threatened by the Israeli military openly, and calling on the world to protect him, to protect other Palestinian journalists. And despite that, he was assassinated. And the response, I would say, from governments and Western media institutions has been muted at best. Anas al-Sharif emerged, he was just 28 years old, but he had emerged as the most recognized Palestinian journalist in Gaza who was still alive and still reporting. He's, you know, a very well-known face across the Arab world, appearing on Al Jazeera Arabic almost every day, reporting from Gaza relentlessly. I would say he's known internationally too, from his, you know, his reporting, his posting online. He was one of a handful of journalists that remained in the north from the beginning of the genocide. There was only maybe something like 30 journalists who remained in the north after Israel forced a mass forced displacement to the south in the early part of the war. And over the past 22 months, he's been a near constant presence on television and online, reporting and enduring this genocide, airstrikes, shellings, massacres, displacement, hunger, famine, dismemberment. He has buried members of his family. He's buried many of his journalist colleagues. So many times we see Anas holding up the bloodied flak jacket of one of his best friends, a journalist who was killed. And you know, this was Anas's fate as well. And he himself knew this is, you know, the world that we live in now is that these journalists are so, you know, at least 238 journalists in Gaza have been killed. That's according to the government media office. This is a record number. We've never seen this kind of slaughter of journalists. And they've been targeted. They've been burned alive. Journalists have been decapitated. They've been taunted by the Israeli military. That's not to mention the journalists who have been wounded, the journalists who have been imprisoned, the journalists who made this impossible decision to leave Gaza because life was no longer sustainable. And they've gone through all of this while they have been abandoned by their colleagues in most Western media institutions, completely abandoned. In the sense that there's no outrage and the coverage of their deaths is abysmal. It's shameful. It's shameful, actually. And we can talk a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. But I interviewed Anas. This was back in December. In September. You know, Anas started receiving threats right at the beginning. I think as early as November 2023, he was receiving calls on his phone from Israeli military officers telling him to cease coverage, telling him to go to the south. He would get pin locations on his WhatsApp from Israeli military officials showing his location as a threat, letting them know that they knew where he was. In December of 2023, they bombed his home in Jabalia and killed his 90-year-old father. He refused to leave. He refused to stop covering. He continued. In October, this past October, he was one of six Al Jazeera journalists that was placed on a hit list. That included Hossam Shabet, who was a drop site contributor as well, who was assassinated in March. And this was the first time that the Israeli military kind of openly announced that it was planning to kill journalists. Before they would, you know, often in the past, they have either denied they killed journalists or they would try to explain it away as being collateral damage. But as the killings continued and there was no consequences for it, they were allowed to kill journalists with complete impunity, then they continued to kill them. They escalated in their brazenness of how they killed them. So they started then to claim that the journalists, after they killed them, were in fact militants. They did this with Hamza Dahtouh, who's the son of Wael Dahtouh, who was the Gaza bureau chief for Al Jazeera, who left after being wounded. And, you know, his multiple members of his family were killed. His eldest son, Hamza, was also a journalist. He was targeted in an airstrike in January of 2024, along with his colleague, Ramir Rifi, Ismail Thaer. And initially, the Israeli military said that it was a mistake. Then they claimed that they were operating a drone, which they did have a drone to film, but it had already been cleared by the Israelis. They had, like, sent for authorization. And then they produced these documents claiming that Hamza Dahtouh and Mustafa Thaer were militants. These were very easily debunked documents. And this began a trend. They did it again when they killed Anas al-Sharif's very close friend, Ismail al-Ghul, also an Al Jazeera journalist, in July of 2024, in an airstrike that decapitated him. They later claimed that Ismail al-Ghul was a member of Al-Qassam, Hamas's military wing, and that he had received a military ranking in 2007. Ismail al-Ghul would have been 10 years old at the time. That's how absurd that claim is. Then it escalated into announcing that they're going to kill journalists. So putting Anas al-Sharif, Hossam Shabet, and four other journalists from Al Jazeera, all of them from Al Jazeera, on a hit list in October, openly taunting them. They assassinated Hossam Shabet in March as he was driving in his car in Beit Lahia. His legs were separated from his body. And he was killed. I personally was talking to him just hours before that. And they said the next day the Israeli military proclaimed that they did target him and said, don't let the press vest fool you. And then they continued to threaten Anas. And I think many people, myself included, perhaps naively, that Anas would not be killed because he was more than Hussein. And more than others, so well known. He really became kind of the face of the Palestinian journalism community in Gaza. But because Israel is allowed to act with impunity, they went ahead and did it. And they were openly threatening him just as recently as a couple of weeks ago. Anas put out a tweet calling on the world to not let this happen. Saying silence is complicity. And he was killed anyway. And I'll just end on the quote. When I spoke to him in September, I asked him why he continued doing this. And he said, hold on, I'm just pulling up the quote. I can't find it right now, but I'll find it.
Sharif, if you want to... Oh, did you find it?
Yes. I just wanted to read one part of
please.
It. He said despite all these difficulties and all these tragic circumstances, all of us journalists are still continuing every day and every hour to report what is happening. This is what makes us continue, that this is our cause. It is the duty of the world to see and witness what we are documenting and what we're reporting. Maybe the world won't act. Maybe the world won't help us, but there might be a motive to stop this war. Every time I document a massacre or event or bombing, I think that maybe through this bombing or this image that the war could stop and this war could end. This drives us to continue in our coverage to our last breath. And he did that until his last breath.
Thank you, Sharif. If you're just joining us again, we are talking about journalists under fire in Gaza. And that was the voice of Sharif Abdel Quddous. I hope I said that correctly, Sharif.
Yes.
And talking about one of the journalists killed on Sunday. Sharif, the Western media, we've heard now many sources, has really been complicit. There, as you mentioned, there's not been much, if at all, any outcry regarding the targeting of journalists, intentional targeting of journalists. There are some, thank goodness, there are some sites like DropSite, like Intercept, like Mondo Vice and others who are bringing this news to the West. But what can we do? What I'm sure you think about this question, you know, outside of the media space, what can we do to help shed light on this, to, you know, just average people to bring this to the fore and to make our media accountable, the media that we're consuming so much of, accountable to ensure that their comrades and colleagues in unsafe situations are made safe, are taken care of?
Well, first, let me I also made a mistake just now that I didn't name the other journalists who were killed alongside
yes.
NS. So six journalists were massacred in that strike. NS is the one talked about because he was by far the most famous. And he's the one that Israel said they were targeting for assassination, essentially. The five other journalists, four were from Al Jazeera also, is Mohammed Qareqa, Ibrahim Zohir, Mu'min Alewa, and Mohammed Nufal. And there was another six journalists for the media outlet Sahat called Mohammed Al-Khaladi. And all of them were killed. They basically, Israel wiped out Al Jazeera's Gaza City crew, journalist crew, ahead of Netanyahu's announced plans to invade and ethnically cleanse and take control of Gaza City. In terms of what media can do, what people can do, I mean, I'm still beside myself at the response and the coverage by legacy media institutions or big Western media institutions at this. They have enabled this kind of killing to go on. This open assassination of journalists, it's really beyond anything we've seen in a generation longer. Reuters won a Pulitzer Prize in last year for photography. Anas Sharif was part of their submission. I think it's six photos. One of the photos was a photo by Anas Sharif of a massive airstrike in Jabalia, where he was born. Reuters' coverage of his death, the headline was "Israel kills Al Jazeera journalists," it says was Hamas leader. And then in its lead, it front loads Israel's justification for killing him, saying that, he was a Hamas militant and responsible for something to do with rockets or something. It then, later on, it then quotes Al Jazeera and CPJ and the UN special rapporteur as, denying these claims. But the framing of it is that it's kind of like a he said, she said situation where Israel's claiming he's a militant, Al Jazeera's denying it. That's the news. That's not the news. That's not what's happening here. There's no credible organization or journalist or any group that has found any of these claims to be substantiated whatsoever. It's only Israel claiming it. And I often give this analogy of what the role of a journalist should be. If you're sitting in a room and two people are discussing the weather and one person says it's raining and the other person says it's not raining, the job of the journalist is not to print those two statements. The job of the journalist is to look out the window and expose the one who's lying. But that's not what's happening. And there's this incredibly bare double standard that is so naked in front of the world in how Palestinian journalists, when they're killed by Israel, how they're treated. When Evan Gershkovich was imprisoned wrongfully by Russia, we saw outrage by Western media institutions. They had no problem saying in their headlines that Russia had imprisoned him in a, quote, sham trial, unquote, fabricated charges. They have no problem using these terms without equivocation. But when it comes to the assassination of a journalist in Gaza by Israel, they're saying, you know, Israel says Al Jazeera journalist was Hamas leader. So this is why Israel has continued to do this, because it can, and it wants to silence the witnesses. The only reason we know what's happening in Gaza is because of Palestinian journalists in Gaza who have performed, I think, the most heroic act of journalism that we'll see in our lifetimes. How to hold the media to account, I'm not sure. Like, there are campaigns to stop subscribing to these outlets, you know, stop buying the New York Times or subscribing to the New York Times or places like that. You can call the editorial page or whatever their public hotline is and complain about the coverage. You can protest them. But this is, I mean, and also the time for words is kind of over. I'm, you know, the National Press Club gave this ridiculous statement calling for a thorough and transparent examination of the circumstances surrounding Anas's death. I have no idea what that means. They're putting out this boilerplate statement calling for an investigation. We know exactly what happened. And Israel took credit for it and bragged about killing him. What are you talking about, calling for an investigation? At the very least, condemn Israel for killing this journalist. And that's not enough at all, condemning Israel. Because Israel does receive some words of condemnation, but the money and the weapons and the coverage continue in their favor. And so they continue doing this and continue doing it in a more brazen way. What needs to happen is, I don't know exactly what needs to happen, but maybe any Western media institution or any media institution, if it's going to print something from the Israeli military, it includes a disclaimer that this military assassinates journalists, or a disclaimer that this military is not a credible source because they lie so much, something, or don't print their statements. But there has to be some kind of real style guide or real move taken to reflect the severity of what Israel is doing.
And finally, in our last moments, we will, if you don't mind, I'm just going to do a very quick reminder that we are in our pledge drive. This information right now, this conversation is just so very important. We did not want to interrupt it earlier, but we do ask you to go to the phones and pledge your support. We have $500 to go for this hour, 800-222-9739. I'll say it one more time slower, 800-222-9739. Or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. And again, our goal for this hour is $500. Sharif, in our last minutes with you, we've heard a lot about, you know, Anas and his colleagues and all across Gaza doing this work, this perilous work, putting themselves, their livelihoods, their lives on the line. But can you give us an insight into the sort of person that Anas al-Sharif was? Because I saw a beautiful video that was posted by one of his colleagues from Al Jazeera, where even though he is in the most perilous situation, he and the other journalists that you mentioned, and forgive me for not pronouncing his name because I don't want to botch his name, But they would send their colleague in at the Al Jazeera studios videos, cheering them up, saying, oh, you sounded sad on the air today. You know, we're sending you a little a light, a message to help you get through. We are okay. We are blessed. You know, give us a glimpse into the person that he was. And, you know, he had two small children. He had a loving wife. If you could just expound a little bit on the person he was before you leave us today.
No, I didn't know him that well personally. I'd only spoken to him a couple of times, speaking to him about his journalism. Yes, he was he leaves behind his wife, Bayan, his son, Salah, and his daughter, Shem. And we have videos of him reuniting with them occasionally throughout the genocide. He was separated from them for a very long time in the beginning when they went to the south and he remained in the north to continue his coverage, and very heart-wrenching videos of seeing them reunite. I think, you know, he, like other journalists before him, knew he was most likely going to be killed and that the world would not protect him. And so he pre-wrote a posthumous letter to be published after his death. And I think we can glean a little bit about him from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he says in there that my hope was that Allah would extend my life so I could return with my family and loved ones to our original town of occupied Askalan, Al-Majdal. So he's reminding people that even though he loves Gaza and he was born in Jabalia, a place that he loves, he is a refugee like most of the people in Gaza. They're not from Gaza. And that they long to return to their lands, which most of them are in the what are now Israeli villages surrounding Gaza. And he also points the finger at the world. You know, he said, I've lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times, yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification. And I think that also is very true. If you watched Enes's coverage, he was always there on the scene, reporting on the suffering of his people, but also trying to convey, when he could, moments of hope and resilience of Palestinians in Gaza. And he continues to write, quote, so that Allah may bear witness against those who stayed silent, those who accepted our killing, those who choked our breath, and whose hearts were unmoved by the scattered remains of our children and women, doing nothing to stop the massacre that our people have faced for more than a year and a half. So, and he ends it by saying, do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I don't know how to put it better.
Yeah, that sums it up. If I may just ask you one more question. Netanyahu, of course, announced, ironically, a few days before Anas's assassination and the assassination of all of the news team, that they were considering letting in international journalists. The other tension we see here is that somehow, and I'm speaking now among, you know, the Western media, not seeing their Gazan counterparts as, and I'm using air quotes, but real journalists or viable journalists. Could you speak a little bit to that? And also what it would look like, I mean, what an international journalism corps going into Gaza would look like and how that might change what comes out of Gaza.
I mean, Palestinian journalists are performing, as I said, the most heroic act of journalism that we've ever seen. They're covering a genocide that is being live streamed, that they're covering, that is happening to them as well. And they're suffering everything that they're covering. They've all had family members killed. They've all been displaced. They're all hungry or starving. For someone to say that these are not real journalists is shameful. Mm-hmm. Allowing in foreign journalists, I think, should happen, but not because we question at all the veracity of the reporting of Palestinian journalists in Gaza. international journalists should be allowed in unembedded for two reasons. One is to shoulder the burden and the labor of covering this genocide. It has been left to these journalists in Gaza alone for the past 22 months to cover the most violent conflict of this century and of generations. So international journalists need to go in for that reason. Mm. And the other reason they need to go in is because of this racism, because Palestinians are not seen essentially as human by much of the world's elites and world's governments, that this is allowed to happen and that journalists as well are allowed to be assassinated. Allowing in foreign journalists, international journalists, will act as a shield in some small way, will act as a shield for Palestinians in Gaza and for Palestinian journalists in Gaza, because I don't think Israel would be allowed to bomb and kill scores of Western journalists and get away with it. In fact, I know that they won't be able to. So maybe that's the only other reason we should be allowed in. But to say that we don't have reporting from Gaza because international journalists can't get in is a shameful statement. John Simpson of the BBC said that. He said, we don't know what's happening because we're not allowed in. You do know what's happening. Palestinian right. journalists are covering it. Right. And you can employ them and work with them, as we have done at DropSite, as other places like Electronic Intifada and other places have. They all put their numbers on their Instagrams and on their Twitter accounts. They want to work. They want their voices to be heard. This is a shameful moment, I think, for all of these legacy media institutions. And I think it's having an effect. Their credibility, mm-hmm. I think, will never be the same after this.
Sherif Abdel-Qaddous, I want to thank you so very much for joining our WPFW audience this morning. Again, Sherif Abdel-Qaddous is journalist and Middle East North Africa editor at DropSite News, and so much more, and a Pulitzer Prize winner, we should say. So,
not a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Oh, it was a nomination.
It was a Peabody and an Emmy, but not.
Oh, sorry. Okay. That's Come fine. On, should we split hairs on those three now? Well, Sherif, we're so proud of you. We do feel a little bit of ownership because we remember the early days at Democracy Now! And we thank you for taking the time out to have this important moment with us and really shedding a light on lots that our WPFW audience didn't know. So you're welcome back anytime. We hope you will come back again and again.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be on WPFW.
Take care. We're going to go actually to a clip right now Mike has ready of Anas al-Sharif speaking, and then we will return with our next two guests. The pitching has been a little different this morning. We ask you, and Sue Goodwin, our news director, will be joining me a little bit after the break, but we ask you now to go to the phones and make that call that makes the difference. You made that interview possible. We're able to remember the journalists on the ground in Gaza here at WPFW because of your support, because you make space for these kinds of conversations. So let's support We the People this morning, $500 to go. The number is 800-222-9739, wpfwfm.org. We are now going to hear from martyred journalists, just a short clip of Anas al-Sharif.
And this is what I was talking about a few minutes ago, that people are now falling on the streets of Gaza from the severity of hunger. And this injured person who was wounded now has no treatment. And this is the case of all people in the Gaza Strip, now collapse on the ground one after another. They need one meal. They need one loaf of bread. They need one sip of water.
And again, the voice of Anas al-Sharif there, voice of his people, all the journalists we see in Gaza staying there because they know that that is the way that the world will know what is happening to them. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. And we're going to move now into our next segment, but really it's all related. And I want to introduce our next two guests, our own Chuck Modiano here, our co-host for The Collision, and of course, always in the streets covering everything that's happening, as well as Nini Taylor, who is with both the Free DC Project, as well as founder of Harriet's Wildest Dreams. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for being here, as always.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know how much. I think you came in on the tail end of the discussion we were just having about Anas al-Sharif and the peril in general of journalists in Gaza. But we see here another kind of takeover happening in the district. We see an occupation, not by Israeli occupation forces, but in fact by the Trump regime, bringing in the National Guard. And we also see the interwovenness, the interconnectedness of these struggles. So Nini, I want you to outline what has been happening in the city. I know both Free DC Project and Harriet's Wildest Dreams have been out there rallying, garnering support, organizing, mobilizing people. So what is the situation in DC streets right now?
Hey, yes, thank you. So as you stated, I am a co-founder of Harriet's Wildest Dreams and executive director, but I'm also a co-founder of Free DC Project, guided by our ancestor, the campaign of Murren Bury, our legendary mayor for life. And so as we knew at Free DC, because we've been building our campaign out since we knew that Trump had won the president nomination. So we started Free DC in January, knowing that this day will come. So we've been organizing and have structure already to try to fight against exactly what's happening, where we knew that Donald Trump would militarize Washington, D.C., and actually try to claim it as his own. And what we're experiencing right now is what is called authoritarianism and fascism. And so to bring law enforcement to a city that's already overpopulated with policing, with over 34 police agencies, and actually bring the National Guard is a terrorist act. It's not a safety act. And what I'm witnessing and learning and seeing in the Black communities and in the brown communities is actually what's happening in Gaza is worse, but it's militarization. And is that what's going to happen if the people of DC rise up and decide not to be disrespected, not to be harassed, not to be profiled, not to be kidnapped and fight back, right? So that's exactly what was happening. These are law enforcement officers that don't know the laws of DC because that's not their job to know the laws of DC. It's a local MPD who know the laws of the DC. And so right now it's really scary what's happening, but I want people to know that we've been here before. And that as you organize and center joy, prioritizing joy and take up space, I believe that we can win and not give DC to Trump and this racist administration.
And Nini, I'm going to I just want to echo what you're saying, because yesterday I was out at the Raza Media Accountability Encampment, which is at 400 North Capitol Street in front of a building that houses C-SPAN, NBC, Fox, and others. And they have a list of demands. But what stunned me was the amount of police presence when there were only about 20 people there at the encampment. And yet there were at least, I would say, 15 officers and several cars for this one small group. And so I can only imagine, you know, I saw the videos of the National Guard entering the city. I've seen the checkpoints at Benning Road, for instance. We had two WPFW programmers that got stopped in checkpoints going home and coming to the station. So there's certainly that the racial overtone of what is happening. He is not just occupying D.C. He is occupying Black and brown people, or he wants to take agency over Black and brown people, Black people in this community and Black neighborhoods. Chuck, I want to come to you for a minute. And if you could talk about what, as a reporter, what you've been seeing, and you just heard a little bit of the last segment, how that the murder, the cold-blooded murder and bragging about murdering journalists, how that connects, and the occupation and the genocide in Gaza, as Nini started to outline, how does that connect to what we're seeing here in D.C. and what we've been seeing here in D.C.?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And it's always great to be with Nini, who does so much incredible work on the ground. I listened to the whole segment with Sharif Abdul-Qaddous. Everything he said was absolutely on point. And just the, when we're talking about Anas al-Sharif and the five other journalists killed, this is a pattern, right? The only difference now is that Israel is bragging out loud about it. Because a few years ago, when we were protesting in D.C., the assassination of Shireen Abdul-Aqla in 2022, who was the most famous, and I say Palestinian-American journalist, I might add, an American as well. And we have video, and she's killed by a sniper, Israeli sniper. And not only that, there was a funeral procession, and that funeral procession attended by tens of thousands who were there was attacked by Israeli police. The pallbearers were attacked with batons and stun grenades. Some may have seen the video. Back then, they were in denial mode. Back then, they were saying, we didn't do it. Of course, later investigations have come out. They absolutely did it, but they refused accountability. So what has changed is they've been more brazen, right? And when you cover the streets, there's a chant that always comes up. And the chant goes something like this. When that the police move in, it's MPD, KKK, IOF, they're all the same. That is a common staple chant that we hear in the streets. For those who don't know what IOF is, it's Israeli Offensive Forces. People do not use IDF in the street. They're very clear on what the Israeli police are doing. And I think that's important. And when you cover the George Floyd uprising during 2020, and Nini was very much a huge part of that uprising, you see police acting in the same way. No matter how peaceful the protest is, they're putting all of their police around the protesters. And if you follow police long enough, and I know Nini knows this, following a long time, is that you can tell in the first, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes how aggressive the police will be that day. And it has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with what will happen at the protest. They are on, you often on orders on how antagonistic that they will be. So when I had covered the George Floyd uprising, and then more recently, the post 2023 uprising, and I have to make a distinction after the encampments were shut down last year, because there was a standoff order really up to the GW encampments. And then after those encampments, you started to see a little bit more of their violent tendencies that we saw in George Floyd. But it's very clear they're not working for the people.
And thank you, Chuck. We want to take a pause for the cause with Sue Goodwin here, and make sure that you all know that freedom is not free, y'all. This is, you want independent journalism. We want journalism that holds journalism accountable. That is what Pacifica Radio is. That is what WPFW does. The number to call is 800-222-9739. We did have someone get us started. We have $400 to go. It's we have 17 minutes to do it. And Sue, just briefly, if you could share any words that might move our listeners to action.
Well, Katia, thank you so much. Thank you for letting me join this stellar, important program. And, you know, what I want to say, and I don't need to tell our listeners this, they already know this, knowledge matters, truth matters. Let me say it again, knowledge matters. It's where we know, it's how we know where we are, where we've been, where we need to go. And I want to thank all of our guests on the show today, because they're telling the truth, they're fighting for the truth. But I also want to remind people that 48 years ago, WPFW was created to tell the truth. And for 48 years, that's exactly what we've been doing. And please, please give us your support so we keep doing it. It couldn't be a time when it seems it's more important than right now. Lend us your support. Help us keep telling you the truth. Which all you need to do right now is call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or on your computer, go to WPFWFM.org and click the donate button. Am I right, Katia?
You are so right, Sue. Thank you very much for that. And we want to make this goal today for David Whetstone and the fine work he also usually does in this hour. Oh, we have someone else, anonymous out of Alexandria. Thank you so much, getting us ever closer. $250 to go. Nini, talk to us about your mobilizing and your organizing, and how the citizenry, how the people can get involved. What resistance will look like, and what resistance, the kind of resistance we need in this moment to fight the fascism and the oppression, that was a Freudian slip, but it's true, the oppression and the occupation that we're seeing.
Yeah, so I, for one, if anybody know me, know that protesting is a tool. But at this time, organizing and getting the strategy together is more important in building people power than anything. Right now, I don't even think our local government know who's in charge as far as law enforcement right now. And our goal is to keep people safe. For Harriet's wildest dreams, that's our goal. As Chuck said, me and him was out there and we saw how the National Guards and the police literally came after us in that spot. So now we got this all over D.C. Not in all over D.C. We have the marginalized communities, oppressed communities. These law enforcement are not in Georgetown. They're not in upper part of Ward 3. They're not there. If they're there, they're there to protect property. So at Free D.C., we're building a people power where we need over 25,000 people, where we're there. We got the people in place. We just got to get them trained to be non-compliant. Right? Non-compliant is like hurting people economically where it hurt, boycotting certain things, getting the union involved to not to pick up the trash, getting the people maybe not to pay their taxes. And as we got the new attorney general, how about teaching jury notification? Because your laws and the time that you all want people to serve in prison, especially on a federal level, right now they're arresting people for smoking a weed cigarette. They're arresting people for having an open container. So they're creating mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. So it's our duty to resist. And so right now, that's what we're doing. If you all follow freedcproject.org, we are building a people power movement to resist this authoritarian, this guy. I'm going to call him this guy. You know, I don't even like saying his name. And also to fight against fascism. And the power is in the people. And that's what we are building at Free DC. So if you get involved with our orientation, the next orientation is on the 20th. And then learn about and get involved with our non-corporation trainings as we build people power. And right now, right this minute, our resistance is at 8 o'clock every night. We're asking the people of DC to step outside your house or wherever you at. And hopefully the people that's at the media station downtown who got the pots and pans, bang pots and pans, blow bubbles, just take up space for 5 minutes in solidarity to say that we do not agree what's going on in our city and that we stand in solidarity that they must leave our city. Nobody asked for them to be here.
Hey, Katia, forgive me for a second. I can't help the interviewer in me.
No, go right ahead.
Nini, tell them what jury notification is. Not everybody knows that. Please elaborate.
Right. Yes. Thank you, Chuck.
And so in reality, when you have jury duty, you don't have to find someone guilty, right? For me, I don't think someone should have to go to jail for 10 years because they have a gun in their trunk. Right. So I just wrote, no, not guilty, not guilty. And I have a right to do that. And they cannot take my verdict away from me. And this is what, and then influencing everybody else when you tell them that, does this crime fit this system's time? And this is how you explain to your other jurors, like, does this crime fit this sentence time? And you influence them to say no, not guilty, because of the system that's built that actually caused mass incarceration, and not what you commit the crime, is to keep you enslaved. And so that's what jury nullification is about, saying no to the system that's actually not built for us. And so we're literally teaching people to be like, you have a right to say not guilty if you don't agree. If I don't agree that this person from ICE, I don't think that they will go to their home country when they get deported. No, he's not guilty, because I don't know where y'all sending him. Are y'all really sending them to his country? Not in this administration. They're not going back to their country. He's sending them wherever they want to be. So I have a right to say no, not guilty. By ways of my principles.
Thank you for that, Nini. You know, it made me think about, and of course, this is a much longer conversation, but as we know, I know in Atlanta, they were fighting Cop City. And again, this is another connection, right, between the police forces here in the U.S., even in D.C., being sent to Israel to train with the IOF. So the tactics we see there are the tactics that are being practiced on people here. We have to remember that. And now we have, I believe they're trying to build a cop city, or they're working on building a cop city right in our backyard near Baltimore, in Baltimore. So we do get us free. We do keep us safe, as Harriet's Wildest Dreams always says. Chuck, I'm going to start with you, and then I'm going to go to Nini, and then we're going to do some massive pitching, $250 to go, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. Chuck, what final words do you, as a reporter, with what you're seeing, again, any insight, what you're seeing here, what you're seeing in Gaza, any insight, or around the world where there are marginalized and disenfranchised people suffering the same kind of occupation and aggression and genocide and starvation, all of it. Do you have any words for us coming out of your reporting?
Sure. Well, you know, I have been down to Atlanta in the Stop Cop City movement, and they've been ahead of the curve. And part of the reason they've been ahead of the curve is they've had a GILI program that has, it's a Georgia a law enforcement exchange that has sent many cops to Israel. If you look at all of the metropolitan police officers in major cities across the country, they've all trained in Israel. When we say it's the same, or when people say these cop cities that you just referenced, and there's been research by Renee Johnson that there are over 90 in place to be built in that process, what we're saying is these are future mini Gaza. It's not what I'm saying, people in Atlanta were saying, and that there's a direct connection, not a symbolic connection. It's not a question of an injustice anywhere, is an injustice everywhere. We're talking, there's an absolute direct connection. There have been reports built, talked about it. It's called the deadly exchange. So anyone who tries to separate this is just wrong, does not know the facts on the ground. There have been more journalists killed also in Gaza than the World War II and Vietnam combined. You don't think that's going to come home? At some point, of course, everything that happens in Gaza comes home. That is what happens. So we have to make sure that we understand it's all connected. And the last thing I want to say is that a lot of times movements happen when a journalist that is well known is harmed. When Wesley Lowery from The Washington Post and Ryan Riley from The Huffington Post were roughed up in a McDonald's in 2014 in Ferguson, you saw Wesley Lowery go scorched earth, and The Washington Post let them, pre-Bezos, let them do that. We've seen other examples of that. So the reason that Gaza does not want the media there, because if Anderson Cooper met the fate of the Nas al-Sharif or was just roughed up, all of these pseudo-journalists complicit in genocide would be speaking up, because it happened to Anderson Cooper and not Shireen Abu Akleh, or if it happened to Rachel Maddow and not Nas al-Sharif, then we'd hear about it. So we're talking about white supremacy that is baked in to the media system at large.
Thank you, Chuck. And Nini, you have the final word.
Yes, what I would say is, like Chuck said, All these systems are all the same. And not only the MPD, but some of these law enforcement officers that's in our communities right now have been trained by IDF. So my ask would be that Chief Smith and Mayor Bowser, because MPD have to escort these officers through our city, do not comply, because we have a racist police department. So they're emboldened to support these guys, these tourists in our city, to come to cause more harm to the Black and brown people. So my ask is that you fire Harriet's Dreams, Free DC Project, get plugged into the work on social media. You can go to our websites so that you know the next steps, and get outside tonight at 8 o'clock and hit and bang some noise, make some noise for 5 minutes, take videos and hashtag Free DC. Trump right. can't have DC.
Make some noise for freedom. Thank you, Chuck Modiano and Nene Taylor. Thank you so much for being with us. We want to thank Anonymous out of Bellingham, Washington, saying thanks for your coverage of Palestine. It is our duty. It is our duty. 2:25 to go. Sue, we have 6 minutes, and we only have a minute before we need to hit that theme song. So any words for the people?
Yes, I'll try to be quick here. Thank you to all our amazing guests who come on our air, WPFW, to tell the truth. And listeners, help us appreciate them as well. Call us. Make sure we stay on the air. And we are a platform for amazing people like Chuck and Nene and Sharif to tell their truth. We bring them to you. How can we appreciate them, Katia?
You know, we give them space, and we are able to give them space because the people give us space. So again, the number to call, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. 5 minutes to make $225. Our Wednesday host, Clarence, will thank you if you make a pledge to We the People right now. Do it for yourselves. Nene just said it, right? We are people powered. No cap, people powered. That means you. So again, Nene, Chuck, thank you for taking the time to be with us. Of course, Sharif, who's already gone. It was early in LA. Hazami is just coming in, but we're finishing the hour. Hazami, we will have you back on. We did talk about... Okay, all right. Well, Hazami, in just like 2 minutes, and we'll have you back on to for a broader conversation, but could you let us know what the Khalaza media accountability encampment is and how people can plug in? And you literally have like a minute.
Yeah. So the Gaza Media Accountability Encampment was started because we deeply believe that if the U.S. media and mainstream media didn't manufacture public consent for Israel's atrocities by hiding the truth, omitting the truth, manipulating the truth, and in essence serving as a mouthpiece for Israeli propaganda, that there would have been enough public outrage built when people knew and were exposed to what was happening on the ground in Gaza and in Palestine, and it would have pressured politicians and businesses to break ties with Israel and to stop normalizing Israel's crimes. And so because we know that this is a pressure point of building public approval for Israel's atrocities, we are targeting the media, demanding that they hear our message, demanding that they change their messaging, demanding that they start to expose Israel's crimes and name Israel as the aggressor that it is. We believe that that will begin to build the pressure to stop the atrocities that we're seeing unfold on the ground in Palestine.
And how do people connect? How can we connect?
You could follow my Instagram. We're building other public access points, but for now it's just Hazami, which is H-A-Z-A-M-I on Instagram. And we just put out a public call today inviting people in different cities around the world to create their own media encampments at organizations that are small or large. You know, media that impacts people is oftentimes the small media outlets that people watch, the local ABC channels. And so do not underestimate the power of speaking out at small outlets, because they do reach audiences that even the mainstream larger media doesn't reach.
And finally, just to confirm, the media accountability encampment is at 400 North Capitol, and how long will it be running or be there?
We're open-ended at this point. We're in negotiations with several of the media outlets. It's right now from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Friday, and then we do pop-ups occasionally on the weekends. But we know that we've driven NBC out of their studios, and their staff is now speaking to us about what they could do differently. So there is power to our voices.
Wonderful. Well, Hazami, we're going to have you back for a longer conversation because we want to really go dive into these demands. So we will definitely book you again. Thank you for jumping on, and no worries. You're busy. Thank all of our guests. Sue, you got some parting words, and then we're out.
Yes. Parting words, WPFW, 48 years of telling the truth. 48 years, people. Make sure we keep going. It's up to you. You're why we exist. 202-588-9739. 202-588-9739. Or go to WPFWFM.org. Hit donate. Cash App. $WPFWFM. I hope you enjoyed this important hour. I learned a lot. Let's keep it going.
We the People, David Whetstone is out. We-